As listeners to Season 1 will attest, Philip Ball's cheery demeanour is just the right match for this Devil May Care podcast. He's been extremely good in explaining developments in Flanders and the Low Countries, which is no surprise as he is the author of Neither Up Nor Down, The British Army and the Flanders Campaign 1793 to 1795. And he's currently researching British amphibious operations in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. I've seen his spreadsheet. It's very impressive. Well, here he is talking me through his love for the period and why he's so interested in particular in the 1790s. Thanks very much, Phil, for talking me through the campaigns in Flanders in 1793, mainly, I suppose, we've covered in, for this first season, a bit of 1792 as well. And I have to say that my main impression, the sort of thing that's changed in my head as I think about this, is that the way you've described it makes the whole thing much more messy and chaotic and farcical than I'd thought it was.
It's much more messy, chaotic and farcical than you could imagine.
And it's almost, how on earth do you try and succeed? I suppose it's so easy when everything's in a book and you've got your map and the arrows and everything's pointing in the right place, but the fog of war in reality is just a total joke.
It is. In writing a book on this was, it's like it's like juggling sand. Who's doing what, where, and when, and who they are, and say that it, we've just been doing the last proofs, and I managed to spell several things several ways, sometimes on the same page. the town of Poppering in Belgium, I've spelt four different ways. So not anymore. That's all been sorted. But
you pay your money, you take your choice.
Some of those Hungarian chaps who fought for the Austrians, their names get spelt. And the thing was, there was no standard spelling at the time. Oh. So when you work from primary sources, that's how they've spelt it there. You look it up.
I can't find that. And of course, the British always persisted in including a U in Buonaparte.
Yes, absolutely. Yes,
we don't even making start. A point, I think.
Yes, well, they spell Clerfay, for example. I mean, his name gets spelt so many different ways. He gets his own disclaimer at the beginning of the book. I've gone with this one. Yes, this is it. We're not going anywhere else. But yeah, there's at least four or five spellings of Clerfay.
So, and this is the thing. So your book, it's called Neither Up Nor Down.
It is.
It's the British Army and the Flanders Campaign, 1793 to 1795. And this isn't really the period that many people focus on necessarily. Most people want to know about Belen or Vimiero or Salamanca or Vitoria. It's Peninsular War or it's Napoleon from 1805 onwards. This is lesser visited territory.
This is unvisited territory. Well, it was totally unvisited when I started writing it. It's been visited by a couple of people subsequently, which is slightly annoying. But when you think you're cracking virgin territory and you find there's someone already there, but no, it's they're more the merrier in the long run. They're all very books. Yeah.
But this kind of warfare, I say it's a mess and it's chaotic, but there is something, and I suppose the other thing is there's no really decisive result in the bigger picture in the longer term.
There are numerous big battles, at least on a scale with, say, Waterloo or Aspen-Essling or Talavera, that don't really change anything very much.
Yeah.
I mean, the big one for the book is Tourcoing. There are four chapters on the Battle of Tourcoing, which is a big defeat for the British. A very interesting battle, as people will find out when they read it. But it doesn't really change anything, even though we get defeated and the French get themselves out of a rather nasty mess they've got themselves into. They don't capitalize on it. And there's no real change in the overall strategic situation. This happens again and again. You know, there's a little bit of a change, and within 3 months, everyone's back where they were before. It's not until later on in the war that it all goes horribly. Really, it's the collapse of the coalition that ends the war rather than anything on the battlefield.
So given that, I suppose the challenging question is, so why should we care if none of this actually makes a difference in the big picture?
It's very interesting. It's interesting from numerous perspectives. I mean, for starters, a big chunk of military history that's never really looked at does end up with France ascendant. It's the beginnings of it's the stirrings of the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon is beginning his career here, and as are most of his marshals, all the generals in the French army will have fought in this war. Most of the generals in the British army, pretty much everybody you read about in this book, will be people who are familiar later in their careers, as the Count Langeron, the Archduke Charles, Marshal Jourdan, Ney's in there. Mack's in there. The Duke of York, Abercrombie, Sir John Moore, these people, and the Duke of Wellington, very briefly, makes a sort of cameo appearance at the Battle of Boxtel, where he learns not to do it, how not to do it. It's based, pretty much you could say that for the whole war. It's how not to do it. Everyone's learning. You know, they're developing tactically, they're developing strategically, the generals are learning how to lead.
But okay, so there's a tension there with the idea that this is all just continuing from the orthodoxy of the 18th century, and you know, you besiege, you have your cordon, you do things in a very meticulous way. I suppose, are you saying that that's really on the Allied side, the Austrians, the Prussians, etc.? But is it the French who are doing the learning and starting to realize how they can almost, in 21st century parlance, disrupt that approach?
Yes, you could say that. I mean, I think there is learning on the Allied side as well, but it's perhaps at a slower pace.
I think
perhaps they start the war as the sort of the favourites, as it were. They're obviously in a better position. They've got large professional armies. They've got huge siege trains. They've got vast amounts of artillery and trained cavalry. They're going to win, aren't they? How can this rabble possibly beat them? Sheer weight of numbers, it turns out. At the end of the day, if you've got an the French develop an entirely different, I call it disposable warfare. The famous quote from Napoleon is, "What care I for the lives of 10,000 men?" That is where this comes from. That attitude begins in the revolution. You don't care about these. That's just 10,000 men you don't have to feed tomorrow. 10,000 men you don't have to pay. 10,000 men that will probably have deserted by the end of by Christmas. You know, so we've got disposable commanders with disposable armies. It's got this sort of
a big fat
aggression. This aggression is entirely necessary. It becomes sort of an integral part of the French way of fighting, and everybody else is just then playing catch up. You know, they've got to sort of find a way of dealing with this. I mean, generally man for man, the Allied soldiers, including the British, according to some accounts, the worst British army to ever leave the shores of Britain. You know, they're recruited by the most appalling illegal means, officered by people who basically just paid because they fancy themselves in a uniform in a lot of cases. You know, nobody is trained. Nobody knows what they're doing. There haven't even been sort of maneuvers in the British army. They don't know how to maneuver with more than a battalion. We're in a very bad position, but man for man, whenever they fight, they do very well. So it's sort of that's strange. it's a war that turns everything on its head, I suppose you could say.
Well, this is a great riddle, really, of this period as to why the result happens the way it happens, and it seems quite easy to attribute it to the sort of the spirit of the revolution that's driving on all these soldiers. Yeah, I think you're saying it's more weight of numbers, really.
It's weight of numbers on a tactical level, and strategically, it's just the relentlessness of it. They don't give up.
Right, not... so this all links up to the fact that they don't bother with winter quarters, they just keep pressing on.
Yeah,
you've got people like Du Maurier who are very conscious that they need to say they're going to do really great and impressive things otherwise, because you'll end up like Houchard and end up guillotined. Yeah. So you're basically, there's more pressure on the front. And in fact, you could argue, therefore, that the habit of chopping off your general's head every 3 months actually does...
It certainly has a motivational effect for encourager les autres, doesn't it?
This is a sort of management school technique where you can, if you don't succeed, I'm going to chop your head off.
Yeah, imagine if they did that at work. Oh my God, I'd be executed by the end of the week. Or would I? Ah, there's a question.
Yes. But productivity would be up in the short term, at least.
Yes, it would. Yes. But I think it's almost as much a case of the coalition failing as the French succeeding. You know, it's that they're worn down, the pressure that's put on them continually by these huge masses of men. I mean, the French are raising, by conscription, around 200,000 men a year, I mean, which puts our 3,000 that we send initially into a bit of perspective. Three battalions of guards versus 200,000 French conscripts. They'd have to be pretty good to beat those odds, wouldn't they?
Your British focus, because you're interested in the British army and how it's doing in Flanders in this period.
Yeah, it's not entirely a British focus.
Of course. It's a mixture, isn't it?
Yeah, because... it's a coalition, and it's a story of a coalition, my book. It's from the British perspective, but it's the pressure that puts on that coalition, how that coalition falls apart.
That's really interesting.
That's how the war ends, but that's how the war of the First Coalition, because it basically disintegrates. They don't want to fight. They don't want to be with it. The Dutch don't even want to defend the Netherlands anymore. By the end of the war, they've had enough. Yeah. They don't care. The Austrians don't want Belgium anymore. They'd far rather have Bavaria and bits of Poland, if you don't mind. And we're sort of just batting on a losing wicket continuously, and. But when you're talking about coalition warfare, you've got to talk about the other parts of the coalition as well. You can't just talk about the English. If it had been just a book about the British, it would have been much shorter, I think. But there's a lot of what the Austrians are doing in there, and a little about the Dutch. But
that's really interesting. I suppose that gives you the big picture of the state of play. Yeah, yeah.
I thought so. You know, it's sort of you can't really say, oh, the British did. Well, why did they do that? What's going on there? And I had some good Austrian sources, which is always an advantage in any historical book. You're only ever as good as your sources. And I had some good detailed Austrian sources. And I thought, well, this stuff's just too good to leave out.
And, oh, really? Yes. Hence all your excellent stories, which you've provided for us in the podcast about Mac in particular. But was there anything that surprised you? I mean, what was the thing that, you know, really surprised or shocked you as you were going about the research work?
Surprised me is how good the Austrians were. I mean, they have a very bad reputation, as you say, the cordon and the sieges. They give an impression of this sort of plodding sort of military machine.
But yes,
as an army, certainly sort of end of 1793, early 1790, they're really good. You know, they go out and they hammer the French on a regular basis. I mean, they lose at certain points, but and especially in those small encounters, they're very aggressive. You know, they always pursue. They've got vast amounts of cavalry. They're very good. They always pursue. You know, they follow up on a regular basis. You know, it surprised me how I thought they would just plod along and that, you know, they'd do the odd thing when forced to. But no, the Prussians are terrible.
Oh, really? A difference between them? Oh, really?
Yeah, the Prussians are massively reluctant to be involved at all. They're not interested. They're only interested in Poland, really.
Interesting.
After the failure at Valmy, the Prussians don't really participate at all.
They never really get going again. They flake out.
You know, but yeah. And they there's constant secret talks with the French throughout the whole thing between France and Prussia. All the way through to the 1790, well, through, I suppose you could say through to 1806. But there's this constant sort of negotiation.
Whereas the Austrians are much more committed to keeping going. Yeah, I suppose they're worried about southern Germany.
Yeah, well, there's a point where we paid the Prussians
can't remember, £2 million, I think it was, to send an army to help us. Thought, right, well, the Austrians aren't doing anything anymore, so because there's a sort of deterioration in the Austrian sort of aggression and sort of spirit to fight. They lose interest. Thugut, the Austrian Chancellor, gets involved, and he basically wants to move the war. He doesn't want to fight in Belgium anymore, so he undermines the whole thing, and it hinges on this political. That's another thing that's very interesting. The political points that just change. They're almost the political interventions are almost more decisive than any of the battles, in a way. But, yeah.
Yes. No. That makes sense. Absolutely. It's a real period of change and turmoil and sort of choppy, turbulent, unpredictable. Yes.
Some of the things that I think you're saying, what was the most astounding thing? I think the most astounding thing is the Battle of Tourcoing. Really, it's a vast battle that I came across it because it had been written about by Hilaire Belloc.
Oh, really? Yes. Of all people.
I didn't expect him
to be popping up in this podcast. Yeah,
he's not just a nonsense poet, but he was also a military historian. And he wrote a series of books on decisive British battles, and he included Tourcoing, which is the first time I'd ever heard of it, first time I came across this battle. And he got quite a lot of it wrong, as it turned out. It was very interesting looking at what happened in that battle. And you have to read to find out. But there's all sorts of intrigue. And basically, the Duke of York gets sold out. They leave us to it.
Oh,
and
no.
We're sort of out on a limb and done for. So, yeah, that was very interesting. And if you like battles, this is obviously the book to read. It's there's a battle pretty much every chapter, several battles every chapter.
Gosh,
My mother, who isn't into military history, did the initial proofreading, and she said she found it quite wearing. Just so many battles. Here we go again. But there's a lot of battles in it.
I mean, so your background is you've worked in museums and the heritage sector and even archaeology, all sorts of things. So how did you, I suppose you're used to explaining things of a historical nature to people. And
yeah, it's a strange, how did I end up writing? I think originally it came from my master's dissertation. It was marked and it came back. They said it was eminently readable. I thought,
that's something. That's pretty good.
Yeah, so I suppose I'd got into that by, say, writing exhibition text for museums and, as you say, explaining things to people in a... Yeah, it's hard to see how you develop these. When you look back and sort of sew it together there, that's how that sort of part of my CV, as it were, was developed, was doing that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I suppose it is you're talking on a page. It's just if you can talk to people, you can write, you know. People might deny that I can do that, but...
Not at all. And I think anyone who's listened to this podcast and the way you've explained what happened in 1793, people have a voice that they talk with. It's the same voice that they write with. And so you can look forward to reading that voice in this book. And I wanted to ask about your thoughts on amphibious operations in general at the time, successes and mostly failures. And I suppose what you've said is that the situation that the Duke of York plonked himself on the continent and wasn't particularly bothered about this being an amphibious operation per se. It was just, you know, this was the theatre where the continent where things were happening. Those things.
Yeah, obviously this is my current area of research, which has been going on for a while. There were a lot of amphibious operations. It's not something you think, because, you know, people think amphibious operations, D-Day, you know, yes. Island. Hopping, you know, it's all a modern thing, but there were a lot during the Napoleonic and Revolutionary Wars, and Britain carried out most of them. Usually historians who've written anything about it, which are few and far between, will tell you there are around 50 British amphibious operations. I've got it up to 76.
Do you mean in this period?
Yes.
Wow, that's this period alone.
Things like naval operations. So the Navy did a lot of what you would now call amphibious operations, cutting out, taking of Cochrane, for example, did a lot of sort of taking of forts and things like that in support of the Spanish. So he'd
he'd draw up in his with his flotilla, and he'd land a few Marines and sailors, and he'd take a fort from the French. I haven't even included them.
Yeah,
this is all operations carried out with the army and the navy jointly.
Oh, I so see. Right. Yes.
Six of them during the period. The French also did some. The Russians did some. The Swedes did some, and the Spanish did some. So pretty much the seas around Europe were full of boats from 1793 all the way through to 1815, pretty much.
Very busy. Couldn't go out for a row without bumping into a...
Yeah, exactly. It's Dunkirk, an amphibious operation. A lot of people say it is.
It isn't,
you know. Well, the army were already there. They weren't landed. So by my current definition, that isn't an amphibious operation. Right. But the navy were involved, although they didn't turn up till it was all over. And then there's the whole business about whether Murray, who's the guy who was the chief of staff, famously wrote this letter saying that he didn't think the navy would be any use. And everybody quotes that. They turned it over. He explained why.
Another thing I've noticed is that I think you take great pleasure out of a lot of the personalities that are around at this time, and there are some larger than life figures.
Absolutely. It comes alive, you know. I mean, that's definitely a museum thing. We found when doing museum exhibitions that if you talk about specific people and you tell the story of an event or a period in history through the eyes of a specific, it's more relatable, you know. The people that come into the museum can rather than just what we call a book on a wall, you know. People don't like that, you know, come in and you throw a load of facts at them. Some people read them, although they always reckon it's something like 20% of the visitors will read 20% of the labels, I think was the figure that was bandied around when I was I was doing museum studies.
That's good for morale.
Yes. So, you know, you're pretty much wasting your time. But if you get that hook, if you can get them interested in the characters, you know, this is somebody that could be like you. This is a particular person. And it's always been a good way of teaching history. You can relate to it more if you can remember, oh, that's that bloke that, you know, the bloke with a T, or you know, Van Damme the looter, or you know, whatever, whoever it is, that you can just get a little, you see the humanity behind it.
And I think there's something about this period where which is driving very interesting figures, interesting odd personalities, whether it's Joachim Murat, this preposterous peacock style. You know, all sorts of different personalities on all sides.
Absolutely, yeah. And person, I think it's the period of personality, the cult of personality almost. You know, it's they are who they are and how they think makes such a difference. Just look at the Duke of York. In the book, sort of claim that the Duke of York's personality is at least partially responsible for the collapse of the coalition. You know, this is a man who was pompous and slightly ridiculous and much given to drinking and slagging people off. He blames everybody. You know, he despises all his allies. He's not massively keen on any of those under him, you know, but he will tell you, oh, no, I've done a frightfully good job here. Yes, look at that. And I thought the telling one is he writes home to his father, George III, because Marshal Freytag, the commander of the Hanoverian contingent, has been he's been let go, basically. He's got a bit old and he's been injured, and he's going back to report to the king about what's happened. And York basically panics and sends this letter. He's going to say that I'm perpetually drunk. Familiar, doesn't it? It's like those letters you write home from university denying that you spend the whole time in the union bar. No, I go to all my lectures. I thought this all sounds a bit familiar. So I think, you know, no smoke without fire. So I think there's the famous Gilray cartoon of him living it up by being served by this army of skeletal soldiers. I think there's perhaps a certain amount of truth in that.
Biting those cartoons.
And you read the people actually went, This is the great thing about the period, is enough of it has survived. People that were actually there and actually saw it, eyewitness accounts, people who went to the Duke of York's headquarters and saw this firsthand. And there's a lady who went, Lady Holland, I think it was, who goes and visits him and says, yeah, he's surrounded by all these young men. And these are the people that he dines with. These are his aides, basically. They're a bunch of full of, you know, hooray Henrys, basically. And he doesn't ever invite his colonels to dinner. And, you know, he doesn't speak to the other. And she thinks this is bad. And she can see that. And Wyndham, who's later a member of the government, goes and visits him on a couple of occasions and says similar things, you know.
Oh, really?
This is better now. Implying that A, bad in the first place, and B, it hasn't gone away entirely. You know, it's these kind of things. You know, there's a lot of, yeah, so he's an interesting character. Mac's an interesting character. There's a lot of interesting Frenchmen, you know. It's a fascinating period, and I hope I've done it justice.
The book isn't, at the time we're recording this, the book isn't out just yet, so I'm looking forward to it very much so, and thank you very much.
Yeah, it's
been really great having you on the podcast, and what we'll be looking to do is there's a season two, and I noticed that your book extends to 1795. I might possibly be asking you to possibly come on for the next batch as well.
Well, the good news is that Philip has indeed agreed to come on the podcast for season two, and we've already recorded the interview, so there's no getting out of it now. One of the things I really like about Philip is his focus on some of these more unconventional figures, people like Mac, for example, and we will be continuing that theme in next week's interview, which is with Jacqueline Reiter, whose most recent biographical research is into a particularly preposterous Royal Naval captain. Something to look forward to next week.